Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From NPR News in Mexico City, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Ada Peralta. Good morning. A CDC committee votes to change a vaccine recommendation. What are health experts saying? And in Mexico, an explosion of anger after a mayor's killing.
A las orillas! Váyanse a las orillas!
Also, pop can be mystical. For his latest album, Tobias Gesso Jr. got advice from a psychic.
And I sort of just asked her, do you think I'm done the album or not done the album? And she said, oh, you're not done the album. There's one more song. And she was like, it's this big drama.
But first, the news. It's Saturday, December 6, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Federal immigration agents have made dozens of arrests in New Orleans this week. The city is the latest target of the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. As NPR's Matt Bloom reports, local leaders are demanding more transparency in the operation.
Department of Homeland Security officials have declined to share precisely how many arrests they've made in their operation underway in southern Louisiana. In a press conference, Mayor-elect Helena Moreno said she and other local leaders sent a letter to U.S. Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino, requesting data on people detained.
We've constantly heard on the news claims that this operation is about going after rapists, pedophiles, and murderers. But is it really casting a much wider net?
Bovino, who's in charge of the sweep, has made comments to local media saying his goal is to make as many arrests as he possibly can. Matt Bloom, NPR News, New Orleans.
Talks continue in Florida today as Ukrainian and American delegations attempt to advance peace in Ukraine, even as overnight Russia launched a barrage of missiles and drones. NPR's Elmer Beardsley reports a main issue is the eastern Ukrainian territory of Donetsk.
Ukraine still holds on to a little less than 30% of Donetsk Oblast, but it's a key fortified belt that includes several cities with people who want to remain in Ukraine. Russia wants Ukraine to hand it all over. Ukrainians fear the U.S., in its quest to seal a deal, will pressure Kyiv to abandon Donetsk. Russia is making incremental gains in eastern Ukraine, but lost 25,000 soldiers in the month of October alone. Ukraine's commander-in-chief, General Oleksandr Sirsky, says Kyiv's strategy is to exhaust the Russians and prevent their advance. Sirsky says he does not even allow himself to consider a scenario in which Ukraine would be forced to give Russia the entire Donetsk region. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Colombian government has signed an agreement with a major drug trafficking gang aimed at bringing peace in the areas under the group's control. It's the biggest armed criminal gang in the country. The BBC's Will Grant reports.
The key point is that members of the Clan del Golfo will have to concentrate in three, as it were, demilitarized zones, where they will be, as it were, corralled and gradually move towards the demobilization starting from March next year. On their side, that will also bring with it the fact that there will be no longer extradition or orders for capture of them. So in a sense, it takes the heat out of the chase, as it were, over the years for their top leadership.
The BBC's Will Grant reporting. And you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News in San Francisco, I'm Dana Cronin. Unions representing educators and staff at West Contra Costa Unified are heading back to the bargaining table today. That's after negotiations earlier this week ended with the sides unable to even agree on how the talks went. The district superintendent issued a video statement Thursday night saying the meeting was productive, but union president Francisco Ortiz said the meeting was brief, the district was late, and they showed up with no new written proposals.
So we let them know that we're prepared to negotiate with them when they have something that is written down that we can consider. Right now, there doesn't seem to be any urgency.
District officials did not respond to follow-up questions. San Francisco's school district says it expects to exit state fiscal oversight this year, but it will need to make steep budget cuts first. KQED's Katie DiBenedetti reports.
The district slashed more than $100 million from its budget last year, eliminating hundreds of positions to move out of the state's worst financial status. Now, Superintendent Maria Sue says another $100 million in cuts will stabilize spending.
We are moving closer to fully restoring local control over our budget and exiting state oversight. However, we are still struggling in really tough times. We still need to make additional reductions.
Progress could be jeopardized, though, by an escalating strike threat from teachers. Current spending projections don't include their union's contract demands. I'm Katie DiBenedetti, KQED News.
And I'm Dana Cronin.
Support for NPR comes from the Union of Concerned Scientists, championing science in the fight for a healthy, safe, and just future. Learn more at ucs.org. And support comes from you, the listener and sustaining member supporter of KQED News. In KQED Arts this week, it was a tough year for Bay Area theater, but it still produced a lot of standout moments. Joan Baez in the circus and Hamlet reimagined with barbecue. Find that and more at kqed.org/arts. kqed.org/arts. 9:06 at KQED. Weekend edition continues on a Saturday.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ada Peralta. The Trump administration's campaign to overturn how children get vaccinated against infectious diseases took a major step forward yesterday. A powerful federal advisory committee recommended dropping long-standing guidance that all babies get vaccinated against hepatitis B at birth. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now. Hey, Rob.
Hey there, Ada.
So let's start with an explanation of what exactly happened yesterday.
Sure. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices voted to abandon one of the nation's most effective vaccination policies, a recommendation that all children get vaccinated against hepatitis B within the first 24 hours of life. This has been U.S. policy for more than 30 years and is responsible for a dramatic plunge in hepatitis B infections in this country. That's protected countless babies from getting a chronic liver infection that can lead to liver failure, liver cancer, and premature death.
I can't help but ask why. I mean, why would the CDC committee endorse this?
Well, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has long campaigned against vaccines, essentially stacked this committee with like-minded members, and many of them question whether vaccinating children against hepatitis B when they are so young is really necessary. They also question whether it's safe to give newborn babies this shot so early in life. Here's how new committee member Retzef Levy, a professor of operations management at MIT, put it.
You would never agree to fly on a plane that the aircraft vendor tells you that it's safe. Apply the same level of scrutiny to the safety of your child as much as you will apply to the safety of a plane. And I don't believe that we currently do that.
The committee recommended that only babies born to mothers who test positive for the virus or whose status is unknown routinely get vaccinated at birth. Those who test negative should talk to their doctor.
And what's been the reaction to this change?
Most public health experts are horrified, frankly. They say there's overwhelming evidence that the vaccine is safe for newborns, and babies can catch the virus even if their mothers aren't infected. Here's Dr. Joseph Hiblin, another member of the committee who voted against the change.
The hepatitis B vaccine program is one of the world's greatest achievements in medical health in the protection of children. And for that reason, we have a very high bar before we make any changes to the current program.
And he and other members are worried that other changes may be in the works.
So let's talk about that. This isn't the first change this administration has made in vaccine policies. Remind us what else has happened and what may be coming.
Yeah, the Trump administration has already made it harder for many people to get the COVID-19 vaccines, made it more complicated to vaccinate babies against chickenpox, and changed the CDC stance on a possible link between vaccines and autism, even though that's long been debunked. The CDC committee is now scrutinizing the entire childhood vaccine schedule, which for decades has protected children against more than a dozen dangerous diseases, including measles, mumps, tetanus, and, you know, polio. Here's Dr. Rochelle Walensky, a former CDC director.
We rely on an infrastructure of vaccines not only to protect ourselves and our children, but to protect our communities and one another. Today's meeting was just another one of those chisels in the infrastructure that we are really, really relying on to keep our children, ourselves, and our communities safe.
And the committee laid the groundwork during the meeting to consider other controversial changes in U.S. vaccine policies in the future.
That's NPR's health correspondent, Rob Stein. Rob, thank you.
You bet, Hader.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is under scrutiny this week over two different strikes, one against alleged drug traffickers in the Caribbean, the other against Houthi militants in Yemen, what's become known as Signalgate. NPR's senior contributor, Ron Elving, joins us now. Hey, Ron.
Hey, good to be with you, Hader.
So, Ron, on the alleged drug boats, members of Congress saw a video of the September 2nd strike, and Republicans and Democrats came away with very different versions of what they saw when two survivors were killed. How do you make sense of that?
It takes some effort to make any sense of it at all. There's a lot we don't know about these boats, but let us say that this hit on September 2nd was part of the U.S. war on drugs. If so, then these men in question might qualify as enemy combatants left wounded on the battlefield, which puts us in war crime territory. Yet the first Republican senator emerging from that closed-door hearing on Thursday was Tom Cotton of Arkansas, himself a veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he said, quote, "We killed them, and we were right to kill them." He said both strikes on the boat were, quote, "righteous," and that reports in the media to the contrary were a lie and defamatory. So there is a broad disagreement about the facts that goes well beyond grudging loyalty to Hegseth. It may even go beyond loyalty to Trump himself. And we see something similar in regard to the so-called Signalgate. The Defense Department's own Inspector General this week released a report saying that by discussing the mission details of that strike over an insecure chat app, Hegseth endangered the mission and the lives of American service members. The White House called the same Inspector General report, quote, "a total exoneration," unquote. So here again we see an us versus them mentality that overrides all other considerations.
Yeah, and speaking of Signal, we should mention NPR's CEO, Catherine Marr, also chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. Its subsidiary makes the messaging app. But let's talk about the Supreme Court. This week, justices weighed in on the gerrymandered voting maps in Texas. They sided with Republicans. This could mean 5 more GOP seats in Congress next year. Where do things stand nationally in this redistricting arms race?
Well, there are still some states fighting the map wars, including Missouri and Indiana. And more states may get drawn into the fray by court rulings, so the national outcome is unclear. The Texas map could add 5 Republican seats, but that's not guaranteed. Might be only 3. And meanwhile, the gerrymanders adopted in retaliation to Texas by Democrats in California and Virginia could yield more. In the long run, it could be a wash or a marginal gain for the GOP. And 2 or 3 seats may not matter much come next November. Right now, polls are indicating Democrats are in for a strong showing in those midterm elections in November coming. History tells us presidents have lost seats in the midterms 9 times out of 10 since World War II. And the lower a president's public approval, the more seats are lost. And right now, Trump's at 36% in the Gallup poll, lower than any president that they have measured at Gallup other than Richard Nixon.
So, Ron, the Supreme Court also announced yesterday it will hear another case over President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship. It seems the court has shown a lot of deference to the president so far this term. Do you think that's going to hold true here?
Birthright citizenship goes back to the 14th Amendment in the aftermath of the Civil War. There's always been some debate over whether it applied only to the formerly enslaved or to new arrivals in the country who have babies here. Should those babies automatically become citizens, even if their parents aren't? The long-standing answer has been yes. But there has also been a body of opinion opposed to that. We had anti-immigration surges in the mid-1800s and in the 1920s, and Trump's broad-scale assault on immigration has in effect closed the southern border and unleashed aggressive deportation efforts. But this birthright citizenship case, seeking to change the way we have long understood the Constitution, would be his biggest trophy yet.
That's NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Rader.
Next year's FIFA World Cup is fast approaching, and we now know which teams will play each other in the first round. The draw for the group stage was announced yesterday at a ceremony in Washington. The tournament will take place next summer in the U.S., Canada, and here in Mexico, where I'm based. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
The U.S. men's national team has been on a bit of a hot streak this fall. The Americans have gone unbeaten in their past five games, including wins over Paraguay and Australia. Now, next year, they'll face those two teams again in the group stage of the World Cup. Here's U.S. midfielder Tyler Adams.
I think it's exciting to be familiar with the opponents that we're going to play against, but I think everyone knows that nothing is like a World Cup game.
The Americans' third group stage opponent will be determined by a miniature playoff held next March. It could be Turkey, Slovakia, Romania, or Kosovo. Overall, that's a very favorable draw. Plus, playing at home is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, says American star Christian Pulisic.
It's what we dreamed of as kids, and just to have the opportunity, I think it is important to go into it with the mentality that we're gonna enjoy it. We're gonna try to take in the whole experience, but obviously we're gonna be ready to fight. We're gonna give it everything we have.
The favorites to win the World Cup are heavyweights like Spain, England, France, Brazil, and Argentina, but it'll be easier than ever to at least reach the knockout stage thanks to the expansion of the tournament. Now the top two teams from each of the 12 groups will move on, plus a bunch of third-place finishers. That could lead to some Cinderella runs. Here's Australian head coach Tony Popovich speaking to reporters in a noisy room after the draw.
When you're in the knockout stages, then that's a one-off game and you never know what can happen. We'll have to earn it, but if we can get through the knockout stages, then anything's possible.
One of those underdogs next year will be Haiti, which is making just its second ever World Cup appearance. Head coach Sebastien Minier led his squad to qualification despite not being able to play any games at home due to violence there. Now there's another obstacle. Haitians have been banned from traveling into the U.S. since an executive order signed by President Trump last June, meaning it'll be impossible for some fans to come.
Normally it's a big party, the World Cup, so you need to invite all the citizens in the world. I think it would be the case, but we have a lot of Haitians in U.S., so we will see.
For fans from many other countries, the U.S. requires visas to visit, and the wait for an appointment can be months long. Last month, the White House announced priority appointments for hopeful visitors who've purchased tickets through FIFA, but officials stressed it's not a guarantee that they'll be granted a visa. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
On KQED News, more of the program is ahead on this Saturday morning. 918, I'm Michael State. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and an on-stage blizzard. Runs now to December 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. And John Muir Health, offering comprehensive cancer care with a team approach and advanced treatment options at the UCSF John Muir Health Gene and Ken Hoffman Cancer Center in Walnut Creek.
You probably have opinions on whether or not you should share your location with your friends and family.
That man does not need your location.
This week on It's Been a Minute, we're weighing the pros and cons.
And on Wildcard, author Jason Reynolds on being a big crier.
I am a crybaby of all crybabies. It is my favorite thing about myself.
That's on Wildcard, and it's been a minute from NPR.
Coming up at 10 this morning.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Supreme Court agreed yesterday to consider the Trump administration's executive order attempting to restrict birthright citizenship. A lower court had ruled the order violates the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Ukrainian and American delegates will meet for a third day in Miami today on finding a way to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff says they're making progress in the negotiations. And part of the Tower of London was closed today after protesters smeared apple crumble and yellow custard on a display case containing the Imperial State Crown. The protesters want the government to tax the extremely wealthy. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Ahead on Weekend Edition, the latest on the economy with NPR's Scott Horsley. Coming up in the next half hour, some NPR staffers recommend some fiction books that they think you will love, because they love them. More on that story, too, on the program. Good morning. 920 support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. And whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And the listeners of KQED, 88.5 in the Bay Area, 89.3 in Sacramento. It's now 9:21.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ada Peralta. Many people are not feeling very festive about the economy as the holidays approach, but they're not quite as gloomy as they were a month ago. NPR's Scott Horsley has been keeping tabs on the economic spirit of the season, and he joins us now. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Ader.
So, Scott, with 19 shopping days till Christmas, it sounds like people are feeling a little grinchy. What's going on?
Yeah, we just got some fresh data from the University of Michigan, which conducts regular monthly surveys on how people are feeling about the economy. And the early readout for December shows a little improvement from the previous month. But Joanne Hsu, who oversees the survey, says economic sentiment is still pretty downbeat compared to where it was this time last year.
Overall, consumers are not feeling that confident about the economy. They don't feel like they're thriving.
And that's backed up by some numbers we just got from the Commerce Department. These are not as timely as the Michigan survey. They're from September, but we're just getting them now because they were held up by the government shutdown. They show that inflation in September was still pretty high. Prices were up 2.8% from a year ago. On the plus side, inflation doesn't seem to be getting a lot worse, but unfortunately, it's not getting much better either.
Is that what's making people so anxious about the economy?
High prices are certainly part of the story. The Commerce Department says personal spending increased in September, but just barely enough to keep pace with those rising prices. So people feel like they're spending more, but they're not getting any more to show for it. You know, they're just kind of treading water, which is frustrating. Spending on big ticket durable goods was actually down in September. And Joanne Hsu says that suggests people are feeling anxious and keeping a tight grip on their money.
When they feel confident, they tend to spend more. When they feel less confident, they tend to spend less. Right now, consumers are feeling pressures on both sides of their budget. They remain very frustrated by the persistence of high prices, but they're also seeing some weakening prospects for their incomes.
Now, wages are still climbing on average, but not as fast as they had been, and there's concern that the job market is losing steam. You know, unemployment's climbed from 4% at the beginning of this year to 4.4% in September. That's still low by historical standards, but people feel like, gosh, if I'm struggling to pay the bills now, what happens if the job market really turns south and a lot of people get laid off?
So next week, the Federal Reserve will hold its last policy meeting of the year. How are Fed officials approaching this?
Yeah, they're really in a tough spot, you know, because inflation is still well above their target. And ordinarily, the central bank would try to curb inflation by keeping interest rates high. But the Fed's also worried about that softening job market. And the way it usually deals with that is by lowering interest rates. So there's a real tug of war here. The Fed did cut rates at its last two meetings, but minutes show there were strongly differing views about whether a third cut would be warranted this month. Members of the committee who are most worried about unemployment say yes. Those who are more worried about inflation say no. So we could see a real split vote next week.
And what does that mean for workers and shoppers?
Well, right now, markets think it's likely the Fed will cut its benchmark interest rate by another quarter point. It's not a slam dunk, and there could be more dissents than usual. But if those forecasts are right, that would make it a little cheaper to borrow money to buy a car or get a new refrigerator or whatever. And the idea is that increased demand would perk up the economy a little bit and prompt employers to keep more people on the payroll. in that University of Michigan survey, people do say they feel a little more confident about where the economy is going to be in the future than where it is right now, although even that future outlook's not all that optimistic.
And NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here in Mexico, an assassination has made huge waves. Carlos Manso was the mayor of a city called Uruapan in the state of Michoacán. He launched a full frontal assault on organized crime. He told his officers to shoot criminals without hesitation. In a country drowning in corruption and violence, he became a folk hero. But during last month's Day of the Dead celebration, he was killed by a lone gunman. Protests erupted in his state, and last month, the indignation spread here to Mexico City. Thousands walked the streets of downtown, led by a big band. Some protesters danced like Carlos Manso used to. But as the crowd gets closer to the presidential palace, the chants grow angry. End the agreement, they denounced. End the narco state. When they are feet away from the president's palace, their anger explodes. Young people, old people, people from the city, others who came from villages, band together to bring down the metal barricades that protect the palace. And then they face off with police. Police fire stunt grenades, tear gas, protesters hurl stones. This is for Manso, they shout. This is the force you should use against the narcos, they scream. Lourdes Campos, who's in her 60s, stands in awe. She's seen many protests, but this one had her thinking that maybe Mexico can change. They're going to regret the day they ordered Manso's assassination, she says. A few days after that protest, I find Esteban Constantino Magaña at the main plaza in Uruapan. This is where he saw his friend shot 7 times. He kept driving past this place, but he hadn't dared to stop until tonight. The plaza is still cordoned off. On the sidewalks, on the grass, there are dozens of candles that were trampled when people ran from the gunshots. Right now I feel impotent, he says. I feel sad. Magaña says Carlos Manso's project started small. They set up a table in the town center where they would sit every afternoon to hear people's problems. Before meeting Carlos, he says, I thought you had to be a millionaire to help others. But he taught me all you needed was the desire to help. At that table, they helped people find medicines, they helped them fight back against mistreatment at government offices, and they helped them get access to services at public hospitals.
Hacíamos protestas pacíficas afuera de los hospitales para que
Manso, he says, would stand silently outside hospitals with a placard and a bandana over his mouth until a patient was given a surgery or the medicine they needed. Magaña smiles big.
Nos metíamos en muchos problemas.
We got into a lot of trouble, he says. They all wore straw hats, so they became known as the Movement of the Hat. And Manso became incredibly popular. In 2021, he won a congressional seat by a landslide, and almost immediately, he began causing more trouble. In 2023, he slapped and kicked a state trooper who he said was trying to extort a citizen. The people of Uruapan joined him, pelting the police with rocks. When he became mayor in September, he became a bulldozer. In the same plaza where he would be killed, he told his police force, "Everything changes now." I've been told that this city is run by this person or that person. I want to be clear, he said.
the people run this town. He banned police from covering their faces. He hired citizens to keep watch over them. Manso himself, wearing a bulletproof vest, went on patrol. Once, he even rode a helicopter into the narco-controlled hills and literally called the shots. This September, one of his police officers was assassinated at a checkpoint. Everyone around Manso saw the killing as a warning. Independence Day celebrations were canceled. The town held a funeral instead. But Manso didn't back down.
No quiero que se deje de dar un grito.
I still want to deliver the traditional cry, he said.
Pero un grito donde se pide justicia.
But a cry for justice. Justice for our officer.
Justicia para la gente desaparecida.
Justice for the disappeared.
Justicia para que los grupos delictivos que operan en Uruapan sean castigados.
Justice so that organized crime groups are punished. And then he did something incredibly dangerous in Mexico. He named names.
Me refiero al cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación.
I mean the Jalisco New Generation cartel, he said, and the Knights Templar. Manso was killed less than 2 months after that. At a Day of the Dead celebration with hundreds of others, he had just put down his baby boy when a gunman took aim.
No era una voz que, que en todo México no se escuchaba.
His brother, Juan Daniel, says Manso was a voice that didn't exist in Mexico. He says it was planned. His brother wanted to be president. He says Manso made a bet that a head-on confrontation with crime could get him there.
Era una apuesta arriesgada que... que, pues, finalmente acabó perdiendo.
It was a risky bet, he says, that he ended up losing. Juan Daniel Manso is the Deputy Secretary of the Interior for the state of Michoacán. Organized crime in Mexico, he says, is a monster. Its tentacles reach across borders and into every crevice, from government to business. He wishes, he says, that his brother had been more prudent.
Sí requiere de un esfuerzo conjunto.
A fight like this calls for big resources, firepower, intelligence. It's not a fight, he says, that you can win alone. The big cemetery in Uruapan is full of gravestones for young men in their 20s. Family members sit on graves playing music for the departed. Uruapan was where the brutality of the drug wars in Mexico first became apparent. It was here where in 2006 gunmen entered a bar and emptied a bag full of severed heads onto a dance floor. At Carlos Manso's grave, Guadalupe Fernandez and Maria Martinez bring flowers. Before Manso, they say this place was lawless. Shootouts, robberies, kidnappings. Fernandez stops herself as she mentions police. She looks over her shoulder.
Nos preocupa que vuelva a pasar lo mismo.
We're worried that we'll go back to how things used to be, she says. Carlos Manso left behind two kids. And after his death, his Straw Hat Movement chose his wife to replace him as mayor. I meet Grecia Quiroz at City Hall. She's a petite woman with braces on her teeth. She walks in holding Manso's hat.
La verdad es que yo he venido analizando muchas cosas de él.
The truth is, she says, I've been thinking a lot about his actions. When I'm alone, she says, I ask, what were you thinking?
¿Qué pensabas? O sea, que nunca te iba a pasar nada.
Did you think nothing would happen to you?
¿No te pusiste a pensar en nuestros hijos?
Did you even think about our kids or that future that you wanted so much?
Y a veces se me ha venido a mi cabeza si esto... hasta él mismo lo estaba buscando.
Sometimes, she says, I think that maybe this is what he wanted. Since Manso's death, Quiroz has given rousing speeches. She's calmed tempers on the streets. She's told police that she won't tolerate corruption either. I ask her, aren't you afraid you'll face the same fate as your husband?
Yo te voy a ser sincera. Y lo primero que vino a mi cabeza fue agarrar a mis hijos y yo irme lejos de aquí.
I'll be honest, she says. The first thing I wanted to do was grab my kids and run far away from here.
Pero al mismo tiempo pensé como si Carlos estuviera junto a mí.
But then I felt like Carlos was next to me.
Y si yo hacía eso, yo me sentía que yo lo estaba traicionando.
And running, she said, would have felt like a betrayal. Of course she's scared, she says, but this has now become her duty, her obligation. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's Weekend Edition on KQED. I'm Dana Cronin. The Oakland Police Department needs more women officers. It signed on to take measures to boost the number of women in its ranks 4 years ago. But as KQED's Alex Hall reports, the department is struggling to meet that objective.
One early morning in late September, eight men and women lined up in a back room of OPD's downtown headquarters. They were recruits with Oakland's 195th Police Academy. Kimberly Galvan was one of three women in the class at the time. Growing up in Oakland, there was a male officer who had a positive influence on her. But
I didn't have any female role models in law enforcement.
As an adult, she said she was drawn to public service and became an OPD dispatcher. But as she answered 911 calls and heard female officers responding, it occurred to her, why not become a police officer herself?
I hear what they're responding to every day, and it inspired me, honestly.
6 weeks later, Galvan was no longer in the academy. An OPD spokesperson said she did not pass one of the training courses required, but she enrolled in the next training. In 2021, OPD signed on to the 30 by 30 initiative, a nationwide push to improve the representation and experiences of women in law enforcement. Since then, the department has created a lactation space for staff, and it's developing workshops for women interested in jobs with the department. But despite those efforts, the representation of female officers at OPD, 15%, remains pretty much the same. OPD's Sergeant of Police for the department's recruiting and background unit said that's likely due to attrition, Oakland's budgeted reduction in sworn staffing levels, and the recent hiring freeze. Mary Dodge is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Colorado, Denver. She says that OPD's figure lines up with statistics at the national level.
Despite all the research we have and everything that says that women make good officers, they can do the job, nothing changes.
Mo McGough, founder of 30 by 30, says part of what the initiative does is help agencies tell an accurate story about the knowledge, skills, and abilities that are associated with effective policing. But breaking into the field can still be daunting.
The image of this law enforcement doesn't look like me.
That's Veronica. She recently took the Berkeley Police Department's physical agility test and didn't pass. KQED isn't disclosing her last name so she can speak freely about the hiring process without harming her job prospects. Veronica says she always wanted to become a homicide detective, but staying motivated has been hard.
You go into a place where it's like nothing but men.
As she prepares to apply to other academies, she says it's helped being exposed to women who have done the job and succeeded, including Margaret Dixon. On a recent fall afternoon, Dixon walked through a Merritt College office where recruitment brochures from employers like the San Francisco Sheriff's Office and CHP were on display. Dixon is an advisor to the Administration of Justice program here, where she mentors young women interested in careers in policing, corrections, and the law. Dixon herself completed OPD's Police Academy in 1980. She worked for the department for 25 years.
It was the best decision I could have made. And so that's why I'm so positive about really trying to get other women to do it, because if they get into it and see what they can bring to the job, they'll be happy that they did.
Dixon believes OPD could be doing more, like inviting women to tour the department.
A lot of women feel that way, that, oh, it's a male-dominated job. So I won't even go and try it. until you see other women who say, no, you know, you can do this.
But it's not just OPD, she says. The profession as a whole needs to show women law enforcement is a field where they belong. I'm Alex Hall, KQED News.
And I'm Dana Cronin.
Support for KQED comes from Ben De La Creme presents The Jinx and Della Holiday Show, starring Ben De La Creme and Jinx Monsoon, December 19th at the Golden Gate Theater. Tickets and VIP package info at jinxanddella.com. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted Sabrina Carpenter and Franklin the Turtle, but despite our best efforts, not us. Join us for the apparently insufficiently provocative news quiz from NPR.
Laugh along with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this morning at 11, this evening at 6, and or tomorrow morning at 10.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The U.S. is planning to announce before the end of the year which leaders will sit on a so-called Board of Peace to oversee the next steps in the future of Gaza. The board is to be headed by President Trump. Russia launched a major missile and drone attack on Ukraine early this morning, striking substations and power generation facilities. Russia is attempting to cripple Ukraine's energy structure before another year of war. And a mass shooting at an unlicensed bar in Pretoria, South Africa, killed at least 11 people today, including 3 children. Police are looking for 3 suspects. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Next up, a visit to the fiction section of the virtual weekend edition bookstore, and books that some NPR staffers really, really love, and they want to tell you all about them. That's up in the next segment of the program. Good morning. Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. And Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. Plenty of clouds to contend with this morning and some patchy, possibly dense fog as well. It should become mostly sunny for the Bay today. Highs the 50s to the mid-60s. Look out for about the same conditions right out through the next 7 days, according to the Weather Service. Dry and cool conditions.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ada Peralta. Here's some unsolicited advice. Skip all the holiday parties this winter and read a book instead. And great news, NPR's Books We Love has tons of recommendations, including these fiction reads from some of our coworkers.
Hi, my name is Rachel Treisman, and I'm a general assignment reporter. One of my favorite books this year was Wild Dark Shore by Charlotte McConaughey. A dad and his 3 teen and preteen kids are the last people on a rapidly sinking research island off of Antarctica. They're getting ready to evacuate when a mysterious woman washes ashore in a storm. As the family nurses her back to health, relationships form, dynamics shift, and before long, everyone is suspicious of each other. Wild Dark Shore is a mystery thriller, packed with plot twists and turns that make it really hard to put down. But when you finally do, you'll keep thinking about it and the bigger questions that it tackles so beautifully about love and loss and resilience in the face of climate change.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Hersher. I'm a reporter on NPR's Climate Desk, and the book I'm recommending is Death of the Author by Nnedi Okorafor. It's really 2 stories. One of the stories is basically a fictionalization of the author's own life. It's about a writer who's working through her relationships with her family members. She's dealing with sudden fame. She's trying to figure out what that means for her in terms of like creativity and privacy. The other story in this book, though, is about robots in post-apocalyptic Nigeria. And honestly, it was my favorite part of the book. It could be a standalone story, but the book is even better than that because it's interwoven with this storyline about the author. And then when you get to the end, there's a huge twist, which I won't give away.
My name is Mateen McCullough. I am the deputy chief of the Culture Hub here at NPR. The book that I love is You Must Take Part in Revolution by the journalist Melissa Chan, and the artist, Barisal, who is sometimes known as China's Banksy. It's about what individuals are willing to do for the cause of freedom, real bona fide, genuine freedom. The story takes place in the near future where a techno-authoritarian China is clashing with the United States that's ruled by the far right. Caught in the middle are these three friends who we first meet in Hong Kong. The graphic novel is full of this striking imagery, two words for you, exploding pigeons, and really thought-provoking prose. It can read grim sometimes, but as one of the characters says, take a deep breath and dream of the light.
Hi, I'm Katie Doggart, and I work with the Research, Archives, and Data Strategy team. The book I'm recommending is Isola by Allegra Goodman. It's a historical fiction novel based on the true story of a 16th century French noblewoman. She's taken against her wishes to New France by her guardian. Upon arrival, she is cruelly cast out from the group of settlers as punishment for falling in love, and she must attempt to survive on a small, remote island. As a castaway, her entire existence hinges on her natural environment, finding food, water, and shelter, and most importantly, not becoming a meal for polar bears. Isola is a harrowing page-turner along the lines of the classic shipwreck story, Robinson Crusoe. It's a great book to read in cold weather, especially if you want to feel extra appreciative of staying cozy and warm indoors.
Hey, this is Sarah Handel. I'm an editor at All Things Considered, and the book I'm recommending is Wreck by Catherine Newman. I am a woman of a certain age, and if you haven't yet reached that stage of life when your body starts falling apart, it might sound terrifying. Wreck reveals the truth. It can be, but it can also be filled with warmth. It can be a time to lean into your people and to throw your hands up as each new indignity presents itself, which it inevitably will. That's how Rocky, the main character, deals with it. Rocky's obsessed with news of a terrible accident in her community, and she's also navigating the Byzantine medical system with a sort of mysterious ailment. All that could bring her down, and honestly could make for a real downer of a book, but Rocky really lingers in the beauty of her life too. From the fragrance of her grown daughter's hair to the smug satisfaction she takes turning foraged grapes into sparkling jars of jelly. As a whole, Wreck is both a balm and a wry smile, because it's only life after all. And I say that with full credit to the Indigo Girls.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life.
Those recommendations again, Wreck, Isola, You Must Take Part in Revolution, Death of the Author, and Wild Dark Shore. And for the full list of books we love, visit npr.org/bestbooks.
It's only life after all. Yeah.
It's been a whirlwind decade for Tobias Gesso Jr. Songs written for Adele, Justin Bieber,
Way You Got Me On In My Head.
Time and Dua Lipa. But for Gesso's fans, it's been a long wait for more of the singer-songwriter's own songs. Shine is Tobias Gesso Jr.'s second album, and he joins us now.
Hey!
You recorded the album live, alone in your house, sitting at the piano. Why did you record it that way?
It's kind of hard to... I guess it's not that hard to explain. I think with the first album, I was sort of thrust into this idea that I was like a piano man. I found myself over the years feeling like the record was sort of not something I would go back and listen to because it didn't feel like me. And so I kept on going back to my old demos. And I was like, oh man, like this feels right. I could pull this off. This I could listen to because it's true, you know? And so when I went to do this album, was like so clearly about my life that I was like, well, I want to like be able to sing the way I sing it.
I want to ask about Lullaby. It has a different quality than the other seven songs on the album. It almost feels like we're eavesdropping.
Well, Lullaby is because I forgot to turn the friggin' mic on, honestly. Like, no, I'm not kidding. And it was way out of my range. I was writing songs that I couldn't even sing, and I'm like, geez, do I got to change the key? And then I'm like, wait, actually, the range of this is beyond keys on both sides. Like, what am I supposed to do? And I sang that take and went like, wow, I think that felt right. Then I turned around and looked at my computer because I'm all alone in the basement. I'm like, bah! Like I didn't turn on the mic. It's just like flatline, you know? So the only mic that was picking up my vocal was the head mic, which was supposed to be for like the ambient room sound. And then when I listened back to it, I was kind of like, this is fine. This'll work.
Well, it also speaks to the vulnerability, right?
Yeah, you know, like, and I sent it to Rosie, I think, and she was just like, it's perfect.
Tell us who Rosie is.
She's a poet who lives in Australia. You'll never find her. She's does not want to be mentioned. She's just like a very authentic person. I asked her if she would take a look at some of my lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, like, Everything May Soon Be Gone was just like me writing in my notes app one sprawling lyric.
Oh, I love you. You know it's true. Write it down anywhere. You won't lose. So you may hold that.
She did for me what I do for other people, I think. Because I would say, like, I don't know if this line is right. And she would say, well, why not? I'd say, well, I don't know because it's not very clear. Okay, well, what do you want to say? Okay, what I want to say is blah, 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 this and this. So say that. No, I know, but it doesn't rhyme. So make it rhyme. That was like an editing process that I just wasn't used to doing for myself. I tend to sort of lean more on melody. But like when I was able to talk to Rosie and get deeper on things, it would bring in more of the like symbolism and a more poetic way of writing a song.
Yes, it's true. I wouldn't be anywhere without you.
You kind of retreated from the spotlight after Goon, which is your first album 10 years ago. You've spent time writing for other people. What makes a song yours and, you know, what makes it for someone else?
What makes a song mine is probably that no one else wants it. No, but like when I go into a room, I'm not trying to write a song myself. I'm not even trying to have my story be a part of it. I'm sort of like getting together with an artist and trying to figure out what they want.
Everybody loves the things you do, from the way you talk to the way you move.
Songs don't just come out of thin air because a bunch of people are in a room. Like, they're very hard-earned things. And it usually starts with getting to know what everybody's sort of North Star is. Let's listen to some music that, like, we wish we wrote. How about that? By the end of that, maybe you're stomping your feet and the energy level in the room is picked up and people are kind of like turning into childlike versions of themselves, and then you know you're on to something.
'Cause I've been by myself all night long, hoping you're someone I used to know.
You've done that a lot. It sounds like you like it.
I love it. I love it. But I'm still just as confused by it as I was in the beginning. You know, I always feel like I'm somebody who wishes I could, like, have the playbook. Many songs that I've written, I look back at the lyrics and I just go, how did I do that? That's mystical to me.
We might be exactly like we were.
It's like realizing you might be a better version of yourself than even you gave yourself credit for a moment.
You also credit a psychic with helping you on this album. How?
I was going through a breakup and, you know, feeling pretty lousy, and a friend recommended this psychic. She started asking me all these questions about what I was doing in my life, and I told her I was writing songs again and that it might be an album. I wasn't quite sure. And I sort of just asked her, do you think I'm done the album or not done the album? And she took a minute and then said, oh, you're not done the album. There's one more song. It's very dramatic in how she said it. Was like, it's drama, drama, you know, like, and it was really funny that she was saying that because the album is so, like, sparse.
I hear singing above the walls.
The idea of, like, something very dramatic, I don't know, it agreed with me. And so I just wrote the song I Love You, and I just knew that the ending was going to be this big thing. And yeah, so she ended up predicting that song.
And that drum beat, I mean, it scared me, honestly.
You know, the drums weren't there initially until I took a mega hit of mushrooms, and then all of a sudden I had this drum idea. And the drum idea, even though it went against the complete idea of the album, which was this live piano album, it really, like, added to the song in a way that was surprising, because the song's about this big giant labyrinth of walls built to protect someone who's in the middle, and they want love, but they can't access it. And so the drums, to me, sounded, after they were made, like all of those walls were just crumbling down. It became more powerful, like when it had the meaning that I didn't even intend at the beginning when I came up with it.
So, I mean, it sounds like you're in a really solid place. You are being yourself. You've been nominated for the Songwriter of the Year at the 2026 Grammys. You won in 2023. What do you want the next 10 years to look like?
It seems like every 10 years my life changes in a big way without knowing why, but I'll probably try to find small ways to make myself happy and work with people who I really admire and am a fan of, and maybe dip a toe in and, you know, play a little few songs here and there for people if there's any demand for it, but try to keep it where I can always opt out if it doesn't feel right. And I think that's a huge privilege, but one that I've spent a lot of time trying to get.
The story of my life.
That's Tobias Gesso Jr. His new album, Shine, is out now. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
But then you came around, and everything began to change.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ada Peralta.
You had me deciding who I was.
On the way, it's been a minute, and Wildcard, along with news updates too on KQED News. Good morning. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd, and by year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. I'm Michael State. Good morning. Again, it's been a minute, and Wildcard's on the way next. Let's check our traffic wildcard, so to speak. With a problem in Tracy, here is Laurie Sanders.
And it's on the Altamont, but it's eastbound 580 after Grantline Road. It's a motorcycle down on the right-hand shoulder. Heading down to San Jose, southbound 101 before Capitol Expressway, we've got a two-car accident that's on the right-hand shoulder. And in Pittsburgh, westbound 4 before Loveridge, it's a solo spin-out against the right-hand shoulder wall.
Lori Sanders for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shanyun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. It's holiday season. SFO travelers can take advantage of SFO's remote bag check service in long-term parking. Fly sfo.com/bag check.
This month marks Jane Austen's 250th birthday. Fans say her characters resonate as much as ever for both women and men.
Modern men struggle to find good role models. Her heroes show how men can be men, do masculine things, make the world a better place.
Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Listen between 5 and 10 tomorrow morning. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO.